This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
After the holidays, a little cash goes a long way. The Chime checking account has tons of benefits to help, like fee-free overdraft up to $200 for eligible members, no monthly fees, and thousands of fee-free ATMs. You can even get paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. Sign up for Chime today at chime.com/goals24.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal fees may apply. Access to direct deposits up to 2 days early depends on the timing of the submission of the payment file from the payer.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is the New Books Network. Today, we are joined by Philip Boehm. He studied at the State Academy of Theater in Warsaw, Poland, and has directed extensively on both sides of the Atlantic. He is, for our purposes, most relevant to our discussion today, is a translator. He's translated more than 30 novels and plays, mostly by German and Polish writers. He is also a founder or co-founder of the Upstream Theater in St. Louis, Missouri, which he founded in 2004. And his honors include a Guggenheim Fellowship and two NEA Fellowships, National Endowment for the Arts, and numerous awards for his translations. Philip, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So the reason I invited you today is to discuss a novel that you translated in the last few years that was published in 2019. Originally published in 1940, it is Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon. And thanks for discussing this because I think it's an important book, and no doubt you do as well. And so what I want to do is begin by talking about the importance of this novel. And let's start with the plot, first and foremost. Darkness at Noon sounds like an oxymoron, but it applies to this kind of dystopian Soviet-like authoritarian state that's depicted in the novel. You want to give us a brief outline of the plot?
Sure. The plot centers on the imprisonment and trial of a fictional character who is modeled after one of the leading old guard figures in the Bolshevik, one of the old guard Bolsheviks that had spearheaded the Russian Revolution and then had set about forming the Soviet state. And after the death of Lenin in the mid-20s and the subsequent back and forth within the Politburo, infighting in the various factions, as Stalin consolidated power, he began to purge off any number of these old guard Bolsheviks. And this fictional character, Rubashov, is an amalgamation of several of those. And while the book does not specifically state that it takes place in the Soviet Union, for all intents and purposes, that's the setting. So we are introduced to Rubashov in the first chapter. He has just been imprisoned, and the book takes place. It sounds like not a very thrilling plot because there's not the action that precedes, there's no chase scene or anything. He is in prison. The cell door is shutting behind him as the book begins. There are several interrogations, and there are his ruminations. And the book weaves together these months in prison, the daily life that he experienced in prison, with these more philosophical ruminations, as well as some flashbacks into his deeds as a leading member of the party. So in the course of the novel, we are exposed to a number of the prisoners, as well as life in that Soviet prison. And most importantly, there are his reflections, which can steer us also to reflect on his, becoming a victim of something that he helped create. This was one of the chief models for this character was Bukharin, who was himself purged by Stalin in the late 1930s. And this edition has an introduction by Michael Scammell that also offers some very nice historical background.
In addition to the novel itself, at the end, there's an appendix of the part of the trial transcript from what I think we can reasonably describe as a show trial of Bukharin in 1938, which is only a couple of years or about a year or so before Kessler actually authored his novel. And it's amazing. It's strikingly similar in terms of the modes of interaction with the state prosecutor. And so it's a interesting addition to the fictional work, this nonfiction trial transcript.
Absolutely. And I think what fascinated Kessler and what shocked so many people who had been sympathetic to leftist causes that led to, and they'd been sympathetic to the Soviet Union, and then many prominent European leftists and also in the U.S. wound up as apologists for the Stalin regime up to a point. And Kessler himself was a disaffected communist. I think what shocked a lot of people was the idea that someone like a Bukharin would confess, that they would confess to what were obviously to having committed what were obviously trumped up crimes and invented espionage or accusations of trying to poison Lenin or you name it. And why did they confess? And of course, the gut reaction was to say, well, they were obviously tortured in prison. But Kessler was interested in something else. And here we have a character who is not going to yield to torture, and his interrogators realize this. Especially, one of the interrogators himself falls victim to the purge. I won't divulge too much of the plot, but why is he going to confess? And he reasons himself into this confession, and that's, I think, the Bukharin transcript at the end of the book is an example of this. In other words, they are so committed to this cause, and perhaps also to save someone, to save their family. There may be other motives, but it's also possible that their very commitment to this cause leads them to believe that they have dug a hole from which they themselves, an ideological hole from which they cannot escape. And so they are ensnared in their own thinking. And their only logical consequence is to go along and defend the cause that they had been advancing for so long.
I, too, was struck by the lack of torture in the book. The only torture or something even close to it seems to be the deprivation of sleep that Rubashov experiences throughout the book. But nevertheless, he's never actually physically coerced into saying anything. He does it of apparently his own volition. And as the Scammell introduction indicates, this may have been a point that, and of course, I don't think we, at least there's no indication that we know exactly why Kessler depicted it this way. But nevertheless, it seems to be that even at the end, when death seems to be the inevitable outcome for someone like Rubashov and others like him, that this kind of archetypal character is still at heart trying to give meaning to their lives, and maybe this is the last service that they do for the Communist Party?
Yes, exactly. And I think that's back to this idea of commitment and to what extent they may or may not have become blinded to the excesses that very ideological commitment led to is, of course, one of the main subjects in the novel. And the tragedy, I think, at the heart of this figure is that he does have this awareness, and so he's battling within himself. And if it weren't for the fact that he's a committed atheist, we could talk about his soul, a battle for his soul, as it were. But it's a kind of communistic battle for the ideological soul.
As you mentioned earlier, there's not much of what we would think of as action in this. This is not a thriller from the Cold War. Rather, this is what I suppose we would today describe as a psychological novel, where we explore the motivations of the chief character, and he only encounters a very few ancillary characters that help propel the plot along. I thought it was notable that in one of his Rubishov's recollections, he recalls seeing a Pietà from a museum. And can you explain what you think might be the purpose for that imagery and that sometimes sporadic reference that he makes to having seen that in the museum at one point?
Well, he recalls a meeting because one of his duties as a in his position in the party, and he had a very high position, not necessarily within the government, but within the party. And the party had, in the 1930s, the party was supporting communist parties through the Comintern throughout the world, and especially in Europe, and especially in places like Germany or Western Europe. And he was in charge of some of these foreign efforts. And in this meeting that he's recalling, there's a man who, we have to have a kind of historical snapshot. In the 1930s, Germany, at the onset of the 1930s, the German Communist Party was very strong. And of course, the battling that then went on between the communists and the nascent Nazi Party was very much in the news. As we know, the Nazis won, and they decimated. One of their first acts was to round up communists and send them to concentration camps or murder them. The Communist Party was in shambles, and yet the directive coming from Moscow, and Moscow had the supreme command of the Comintern. The directives continued to be very, very much at odds with the reality of the situation. So here you have Rubishov is going to discipline someone who had broken party discipline, and to break party discipline was an infraction worthy of being expelled from the party, and in the case or being exposed as a communist in Nazi Germany, which would be tantamount to a death sentence. And so he realizes what's going to happen when he, as a result of his disciplining this man. But he's in a museum, and he catches this image of the Pietà, but he can't quite see the entire painting, and he's trying to. There's some solace in that painting, and of course it goes back to a religious image, and I think that the idea that he hasn't quite seen the entire picture. We could take that as a metaphor. We could also take the awareness of the imagery, the meaning of the Pietà, And we could look for some underlying consciousness on Rubashov's part, that will reappear in the book as he examines many of his deeds from a different point of morality, from a different moral compass than simply did it serve the interests of the party or not.
And possibly the hope of redemption.
Possibly, yes, exactly.
Now, the cliche about writing is to write what you know. And as you mentioned earlier, Kessler himself had been a member of the Communist Party. But also, as was indicated in the introduction by Mr. Scammell, he had essentially been a Communist Party agent for a time during the Spanish Civil War. And later, when he returned to Spain to cover the war as a journalist, he was actually imprisoned. And it indicates or suggests that he himself had feared actually being executed as some of his fellow prisoners had been.
Yes.
This certainly gives a realistic disposition in portraying the psychological disposition of Rubashov.
Absolutely. It makes it very real. And when you're describing a novel from what's in a cell, there are so few things in a cell, but the tactile presence of this cell is very important. And that was one of my hopes in translating the novel, that was to also be able to translate that tactile presence of these prison conditions. He also, among his fellow prisoners, were people who used this ancient prison means of communication, tapping on the cell wall, which figures prominently in the novel, and it lends another kind of dimension to the book, I think. The different types of communication, the communication among prisoners, the communication from the guards, who's sympathetic, who isn't, and what can you do, what can you convey through tapping? What kind of emotion can you convey through tapping? I mean, right now we sometimes look at each other wearing masks in the supermarket, and our faces are diminished, but we're still conveying things with our eyes. Well, imagine you're just tapping through a wall, and how can you? We always find ways to express some emotion to our communication, and that's a fascinating part of the book, I think.
That's right. As you mentioned, we're wearing masks. We're recording this interview in mid-March of 2021, and we are still in the midst of the pandemic and the expectation, sometimes requirement, that people wear masks in different settings. And so you're quite right that there's this isolated feel based on the infrastructure that we live in. And certainly Rubashov and his fellow prisoners were kept in isolation. They're not supposed to talk to each other. They do go out into the exercise yard, but even then, even though they're physically in greater proximity to each other, they're not supposed to communicate. And so on the one hand, we get a sense for the isolation that one experiences in this prison context. At the same time, you had mentioned earlier that one of his interrogators, he goes by the name of Ivanov in the book, he interrogates him for a time. He's actually a former colleague of Rubashov's when they were both prominent in the party, and now he's an interrogator. And it's not giving the ending away at all to note that Ivanov himself experiences some of the arbitrary prosecutions and persecutions that the party can exact on its members. And it seems to me that this is another element of the Soviet Communist Party that Kessler wanted to convey, which is how the revolution really began to eat its own through the show trials.
Yes, it's important to note Rubashov was also a leader in the Civil War. And the image that is that comes up repeatedly, and here a literal image, is of the party leaders and the partisan leaders during the Civil War. And Rubashov was a hero in the Civil War. And Ivanov was also very active, and Ivanov had suffered a wound and had to have a leg amputated, and Rubishov had basically saved him by telling him he had to, you know, he could don't think about committing suicide, and you'll get through this. And now the tables, we go forward many years. The Civil War's long over. The Soviet state had been established, and Ivanov, who was an old colleague from the war, is now sitting across the interrogator's table from Rubashov, and basically saying to Rubashov, "I'm not going to let you commit suicide either." So that's an interesting twist. But yes, as the novel progresses, we discover through a series of these flashbacks as well, the backstory of the party. We can piece it together, and the warning that in their belief in the infallibility of their cause, many of these party leaders were unaware that they were also setting up a system that could be so easily corrupted that their ideological track seemed to be clear, but the train could be so easily derailed by one person, and that is, of course, what happened.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
It seems to me that it would have been perhaps difficult to know what motivated people to act within the party. It might have been ideological enthusiasm, but also there's this apparently ever-present fear of your fellow party members. And so, you know, the conformity that is, and we see this even today, of course, in places like North Korea and China and other dictatorial regimes, wherein conformity is an expectation and fear is perhaps or no doubt present or omnipresent through people's lives. And it reminded me of, I read a biography of Dmitry Shostakovich and his experiences in the Soviet state. He was in Leningrad during the war and
during the siege
of Leningrad.
Yes, he was.
And he had to, I recall one incident, he had to report, and he feared that he was going to be arrested when he reported to this central governmental agency in Leningrad during the siege. And he waited and waited and waited, and he was told to come back another day because they couldn't get to him. They were going to interview him, and he feared being arrested. So he comes back on that next appointed day, and he waits again, and he goes up, and he finally has the gumption to go up and ask where the person that's going to talk to him is. And they said, "Oh, never mind, that he was arrested this morning." So
exactly. Well,
which sounds like an absurdist play, right?
It does. And the absurdities, of course, of the system were later captured by many writers. But this is interesting because it's such an early depiction of this. With Rubashov and the Rubashovs and the Ivanovs, the old guard, I think had, because they were part of a group that had set this in motion, and for them, their actions, they had debated, they were steeped in philosophy and history, and they debated about what what policies to implement. And as that generation was killed off, they were replaced with, in the novel, the character Gletkin, whose very name sounds kind of oddly like an automaton. They were replaced by these conformists, these people who were simply brainwashed by the party. And I think there's where that fear that you're talking about is so evident as Stalin's reign continued. The fear disseminated throughout the land in ways that it had never done before. Because in the 1920s, when the party was, after the Civil War, there was this blossoming of this kind of explosion in the arts. And there were lots of free thinking ideas. I mean, the sexual mores were also, the old sexual mores were challenged in many ways. And you had people like Mayakovsky, standing and declaiming verses in big stadiums. Imagine that, a poet in a soccer stadium declaiming a verse. That exuberance had all but vanished by the late 1920s, early 1930s, as Stalin consolidated his power.
So let's switch gears now and talk about your role in this translation. You are the translator of this, and there is an interesting history to the different versions of this that exist. Before we talk about that history, let's talk about you and how you came to be selected as the translator.
Well, I owe that to Michael Scammell, who contacted me. I think he had been in touch with people at Columbia where he teaches, and they had given him my name, and so he approached me, and as it happened, I was very familiar with the book, having read it in high school, and always felt it was an important book, and so I leapt at the chance to translate it, and am indebted to him, and also the staff at Scribner, who were very gracious, and everyone was, it was a fun project, if fun is the right word for a novel about a Bolshevik in a prison.
And how long did it take you from beginning to end to do the actual translation?
Several months. I can't put my finger on it exactly, but usually it takes me several months to a year, depending on what else is happening.
And so this was originally published in 1940 based upon a translation of Kessler's girlfriend, who was an English woman, Daphne Hardy, and we learned from Scammell's introduction that she had apparently, thankfully, begun a translation without permission or even the knowledge of Kessler while she was cohabiting with him in France in 1939 and 1940.
That's right. Kessler, of course, was not going to stay in Nazi Germany. Although he was born in Hungary, his German was his main language for most of his early life, and in his writing, as a leftist, as a Jewish leftist, as a critic, as someone who'd been in Spain, he would have been a prime target for the Nazi henchmen. So he's living in Paris with Daphne Hardy, and then the war breaks out. The Germans are right there at the coming, invading France, and then next thing you know, they're right outside Paris. So he has to flee again, and they pick up everything, and they rush away. And in the commotion, he lost the original manuscript. Meanwhile, she had completed a translation that she sent off to publishers in Britain. He sent something he thought to his publisher in Switzerland. but it was all lost. And at least so we thought. So the book comes out in English in 1940, I think, and then decades later, and Daphne Hardy's translation is the only version that the world knows, and so it was back translated into German, and the English translation served as the main source for all other translations of the novel. Until a few years ago, a graduate student researching in a Swiss archive discovered a manuscript, and this was the manuscript that Kessler had sent to Switzerland. It had been buried in a publisher's archive, and it had some markings on it, some changes, and the Germans used that to reissue the novel based on the original manuscript, based on the original German instead of the back translation. And that German edition is what I translated for this current version.
And are there distinct differences between the Hardy English translation and the original German translation that you translated?
There are a few. They're mostly minor differences. I think that there are different choices as a translator that I made. There are, however, some significant differences in the versions. There is, for instance, a little passage on masturbation in the prison that was not present in the original English. There are differences of translation, such as in Daphne Hardy's version, which, as Michael Scammell has pointed out, has served us very well, and it's I believe that, you know, great novels deserve many readings, and a translation is, after all, a type of reading. There, she divides the chapters: the first hearing, the second hearing, the third hearing. Well, these hearings were really interrogations. The German word "Verhör" is really an interrogation. So there are differences such as that are more differences of translation. And I also was trying to speed the novel along while capturing some of the sharpness of the prose, and that the reader will have to decide how well I managed that. But the novel itself has a different meaning now than it did when it first came out. You know, it has there are so many layers of meaning since that it has acquired since then.
You mean it has a different meaning in terms of the context of the Cold War and what we learn about how the Soviet Union actually operated that might not have been fully understood or well known in 1940.
That's correct. And I think also it's moved into, as the events have receded in time, or as we have advanced in time further away from the events, the novel perhaps functions more as a literary piece and an inspiration for reflection, as well as a study of those times. And as an instrument for reflection, it applies also more broadly. So in some ways, it's moved from, I think, the interpretations when it first came out, with the show trial still happening, made it very, very sharply focused on those events, those current events. And now we look for, well, what can this mean for us today? Where do we see ideas becoming entrenched as ideology? Where do we see people with the best intentions becoming falling victim to their own actions, where they justify actions that ultimately contradict the very ideals that they had set out to defend? And this is something that we see every day today. And I think the novel then serves more, perhaps has more metaphoric meaning today than it did then.
And certainly by design, this is not, as you mentioned, the names essentially sound Russian or Slavic in some sense, but it is not expressly rooted in Stalinist Russia or the Soviet Union. Stalin himself is never referred to. It's number one.
Number one. That's right. Right.
Who is the leader? And so that in and of itself takes it somewhat out of time and makes it more abstract and
exactly.
symbolic.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I was struck by Scammell's introduction and what you just said a few minutes ago about you read it in high school and how this was a widely read book in the United States. And in terms of its publication history, it was a Book of the Month Club selection. Also, Whitaker Chambers praised it, the former communist who had become outspoken against communism. And I was struck by that because I had never heard of this book until after college. It was never assigned to me in college. It was never assigned in high school. Whereas George Orwell's 1984 was definitely something I was well aware of. And so comment upon that. Was this assigned to you in high school, or is it something you read during your high school years?
It was assigned. It was assigned reading. And a lot of high schools, I think, had it as assigned reading. And that may date me. But I think that it was that Book of the Month selection, by the way, really launched the really launched its career, I think. But in the, as late as I think into the 80s, it was frequently found on high school curricula. And, but my guess is that as the Cold War became softer, achieved softer contours, that I think the displacement, it's interesting you mentioned Orwell. Orwell became kind of the go-to book, and this one receded a bit. It may also be because the Kessler book does have these ruminations, which are fairly philosophical in nature, and so it's a more difficult read. More challenging, I should say, read than the Orwell. And the Orwell is so metaphorical, whereas this, reading Darkness at Noon, is your reading is greatly enhanced if you know some of the history. So you probably read Orwell in English class, but what Where do English classes and history classes diverge in the curriculum? And that's and I think also the way that curricula have changed over the years is a important subject. I mean, to what extent historical, you know, what is our historical awareness and how does that change over time?
I want to ask you briefly about the philosophy of being a translator. I've read of the so-called tyranny of the translator, and I'm curious what your opinion of this debate is in regard to how, quote-unquote, literal you should be versus what degree of license in terms of choices that you have and how that affected your translation of this, but also other works as well.
Well, in my mind, every book is different, and I don't have an ideology about translation, and I try to listen to the voice or voices of a given book, and I listen until I hear it in the original. And then I reimagine it in English. And the way that usually happens is I just sit with it for a while, and I'm thinking of the register of the book, the tone. What is the quality? What are the words that place this in its time? What about matters of class, as speech reveals class? And so the question of literalness, because I think we're striving to convey something, just like the novel itself is more than the words on the page. There's the emotions that it evokes, the thoughts that it inspires. And can I capture that energy in the book? And how best can I capture that energy? Well, that is true to the original. And sometimes being true to the original means also recognizing that energy is best served by reordering a sentence, but or even a paragraph. In some cases, I've worked with authors who are very understanding, and we've agreed to cut out a paragraph or substitute something. You're going to lose something in one place. Well, you can counterbalance that by adding something to make up for that in another place. So I'm definitely not on the side of the word for word literal rendering.
And so sometimes a translation is more than just a translation. It's also kind of an edited work, different from the original.
Right. And we get into a discussion about where does a translation, you know, how to define a translation, what is an adaptation. But I think that it's a reimagining. I would compare it to a conductor. You're working obviously in a different medium, but you know, when you go to the symphony, you hear Brahms' Third Symphony, and you're every time you hear it, it's going to be different. Obviously, with a printed version, we don't have as many versions of Kessler's book as we do versions of Brahms' Third Symphony, but the conductor is trying to take this work and convey it in a way that conveys the gist of the piece, and so I think that's what that's how I would view it, perhaps.
Well, lastly, I want to ask you about your own experiences during the Cold War. It's my understanding you had spent some time in Eastern Europe, and so you have a little bit of personal familiarity firsthand with the dictatorial governments in Eastern Europe. Can you give us a little bit of that explanation for your background there?
Yes, I spent several years in Poland in the last years of the communist regime. And by that point, it was obviously, as my friends from South America would say, it was, you know, dicta blanda, not dictadura, but it was not, you know, it was not the oppressive, it was a different, it was a soft dictatorship, let's say, or a soft corrupt government. It was a government without a mandate, basically. And this was following martial law in Poland, and there had been a coup, and the Jaruzelski had taken over. So, and the party was in power, and the party did resort to its to certain dirty tricks, and you could see it. When I first got there, there were still demonstrations on the streets that were being broken up with vigor by these riot police that the communist government had sent in, and they were mostly, you know, young people who were not so educated. They were often, they'd been given alcohol and, you know, given their marching orders, and but yeah, I experienced kind of the tail end of that, and I was directing plays, and every time I put on a play in those years, I would have to meet with someone from the Office of Censorship, you know, which is kind of it's amusing to relate that now. But so I did indeed have some experience, and also I think certainly I never experienced anything remotely like this. But the vestiges of this remained in some of the language, and also the corruption of the government, the arbitrariness by which someone in, let's say you're eligible for a scholarship and someone in the Ministry of Education doesn't like you, and then they decide, well, I don't like this person, they're not going to get that scholarship. You know, there's no, it was just, there was so much basic, you know, corruption. And the system was bankrupt in many different ways. There were, however, also some things that system had somehow supported. I would call it the babies in the communist bathwater, such as at least in some places there was ongoing support for the arts. There were some things that they, you know, that those governments did accomplish in the name of this or that ideology, but it certainly does not excuse their fundamental bankruptcy.
And of course, these were always art that were in support of the state.
No, not necessarily. And there it varies. We tend to think of the communist bloc as one that everything was the same. But at least in Poland, after the original Solidarity, the first wave of Solidarity, and then the subsequent imposition of martial law, the theaters were often allowed to put on plays that were quite critical, and there was this interesting interaction, writers and between the writers and the state, so satire became very advanced, and often the plays, I think that the government was actually fairly clever because they were allowing this, whereas in places like East Germany, that the censorship was more rigid. But these plays, I mean, I remember going to a performance of Beaumarchais's Marriage of Figaro, and the actor read a line and made a word sound like Valença, like Lech Valença. And this titter went through the audience. Now that play, there was really nothing. There was nothing worrisome to the state in that production, but it kind of allowed the audience to let off a little steam. And I think that the powers that be realized that. And so there was an interesting action. There are many thoughts about the role of censorship and how, for some writers develop their entire oeuvre against the censor, and when the system changed, their writing became less important. They didn't have anyone to write against anymore. Others were able to move beyond that, and so that, it's a very interesting study. But that would be another discussion, I think.
Well, the book is Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon, and we've been joined today by its translator for the latest edition of it, recently rediscovered in 2015 and published in 2019, Philip Boehm. Philip, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you.